all of our witnesses this morning. We have a very impressive panel put together here, and we're going to be hearing about the National Governors Association cluster policy, along with the Community Development Block Grant Program. And with that, welcome. Glad to see you all back here before the committee, I think. Everyone's testified here before, so great to see you all. Good morning, and please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Economic Community Development Department. With me are Claire Berger from Governor's Office, Duncan Wise from Oregon Business Council, and Marion Hammond from my organization working on innovation and technology. We are four people of a team of individuals that were selected through a competitive process to make an application for consideration by the National Governors National Governors Academy for work in cluster-related activities. You, as a committee and individuals, have heard us talk about cluster industries probably to the point where you probably don't want to. You want to find a new word to describe these. But the industry, as what used to be more industry sectors in the days of old, where you had the Detroits, which were industry-based at automotives, you had those type of industry opportunities. The mantra today is using the word cluster, the assimilation of like businesses with common interests, either on product or manpower, in order to accomplish tasks at a more desirable economic rate. So we made our application to the NGA. We were selected, and interestingly enough, we were selected at a very high level of scoring in our application. So much credit goes to the writer of the application, Claire. And I've given you, in front of you, is kind of a one-pager, a summary that I'm working off of, and I'm just going to kind of jump around a little bit. Again, the purpose of what we were trying to accomplish at this cluster activity was to create an aligning of the state around a cluster-oriented framework to advance Oregon's economy. And I think you as committee members and as just citizens realize that when we talk about economic opportunities, there are many partners in that discussion. Particularly with this group, you can see we have business related through Duncan's activities. We have Cam Price from community colleges, because she and her community colleges work diligently on creating workforce opportunities for many of our Oregonians. And we have Lori Warner from Employment Division, who, you know, is her goal is to either offer opportunities or retraining opportunities to get people back employed into the system of Oregon's economy, so we don't have a high degree of unemployment. So we all feed as partners into this activity. And so one of the things we wanted to bring to this discussion was how do we bring ourselves together in a way that we can move an agenda around economy, improving Oregon's economy, but at the same time make sure we're all going down the same path so our work complements each other's in this day-to-day activity. Again, as you'll see on my handout, the other people who are listed, I think the other thing is worth noting here is that we've had a great relationship and representation from the governor's office. Claire, as a representative on workforce activities, Tim McCabe, also on economic activities, has helped, and then relative to education components, too, we also have the advisor for James Taze also working with us on education activities. So, again, a great gathering of people working on a common agenda. We went to a training session in Chicago. We went there with one plan in mind, which was kind of interesting. We went there and said, we've got this figured out. We know what we're going to talk about. And after we were there for those 2 days, we all came back and said, well, did we learn a lot? And did we learn where things, where we were doing going the right way, and where we found out maybe we weren't headed in the right direction? And so we've come back and kind of regrouped our strategy is of how we're going to have a deliverable that we'll be able to present to you in the 09 session that really shows a very comprehensive, well-thought-out plan and procedure of industry recruitment and expansion opportunities, and build it around attributes of building off the best workforce we can have. Claire, I'm going to ask Claire to talk a little bit about some other components of this and some of the work she's been doing on. And then after that, I'm going to have Marion give you a slideshow or PowerPoint presentation, kind of summarize this. Let Duncan talk to you a little bit about how this fits into the years of work that he and his group have been working on around cluster industries and getting them advanced. Then I want to, Mr. Chair, if I could, then have Cam Price come forward, give a little kind of a couple of comments about the community college component. Cam and Duncan will have to leave at 8:30 because they have a community college meeting starting pretty soon. And then I would ask Lori Warner to come up and kind of put her piece together on the employment piece, if I might.
That sounds fine. Keeping in mind that Duncan and Cam have to leave, we only have 15 minutes, so...
Would you like me to go ahead?
Why don't you go ahead and then I'll let you go ahead.
I'll make my very, very quick. Representative Witt, Chair, and Committee, for the record, my name is Claire Berger. I'm the Workforce Policy Advisor for the Governor. The Governor is very, very committed to this effort in aligning the state agencies and basically the whole state around an economic strategy that will help grow the economy in areas that it has the greatest assets and greatest chance for growth. We're working very closely with Bob and Economic Development on this, and with all the other agencies on this as well. It's including my work is specifically in helping to integrate workforce and economic development together, which is something that we've been really wanting to see happen in the last couple of years, particularly with Bob's able leadership. We've been able to kind of move forward and do some really interesting things, particularly in relation to this particular project. And we have other advisors also involved in making this happen. What we'd like to do is we'd like to see this ultimately move around or actually develop a key economic strategy and set of goals for the economy that is inclusive of workforce as well as other areas of economic development. And we're actually seeing that happen. And I think Marion is going to talk a little bit about what some of our key strategies are. The other thing I think I want to say is that we are connecting. We talked with you on Monday about the about the Future Workforce Needs Project, and we are using some of that data and information to enhance what we're doing and make some of these things happen. So,
that's great.
Okay.
Mary, why don't you go ahead and do the...
I don't know if the microphone is picking me up.
You also, Mr. Chairman, committee members, you have this as a document in front of you.
Thank you.
And I will try to... Since I'm conscious of time, I'll go quickly. But Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marion Hammond. I'm the Innovation and Economic Strategies Division Manager for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. And you've already kind of gotten the tee off of the NGA process, but just to run quickly through the structure of the program, the key value of participation for Oregon in an NGA policy academy is really getting that technical assistance from the National Governors Association's technical experts. When we were back in Chicago, we had the opportunity to hear high-level data presentations from the monitor group about Oregon's economy and also about some of the other strategies that other states are employing. We had the opportunity to share best practices with other states, and it also gave the opportunity for agency directors to have two solid days of strategic planning, which can be challenging when everyone's focused on their day jobs. So, great opportunity. In terms of the value of the cluster approach, the key opportunity is to aggregate business needs. So rather than focusing one business at a time, responding to their individual needs on a one-off basis, by using a cluster approach, we look at the shared needs of multiple groups of businesses, which can include a workforce needs, research and development, infrastructure, so that by working together on those shared needs, we're helping move the ball for the entire industry rather than one business within the industry. it also helps communities garner their assets and maximize those to help grow businesses in their regions. And perhaps most importantly for our project, it helps align state agencies, recognizing that the Economic Development Department is certainly not the only agency in the state that's responsible for the state's economy. Clearly, Department of Education, community colleges, lots of other partners have a key role in helping grow the economy. We've already basically covered the goal for the Oregon project. We actually, as Bob said, have probably one of the most ambitious goals of the states in the project. Some of the other states were focusing in on individual agencies or individual sectors, but for Oregon, we really saw this as an opportunity to align at the statewide level and try to fundamentally change the way that we approach economic development in the state. So progress to date, we've already talked about that Chicago meeting, and we've been working on a more than monthly basis since then to continue to identify focus areas. Bob mentioned that we've started to narrow in on where we want to focus for the first 1 to 2 years of the project, and looking around at the states, looking at the assets in local communities, and also on the strategic opportunity for Oregon, we've decided to focus on sustainable clean energy as the initial project. When you look at wind, solar, geothermal, et cetera, those are clearly areas that cover every region of the state. We know that clean energy is an important goal for the United States and internationally, and we see it as a key opportunity to help drive economic development. So that'll be the initial focus. So in terms of next steps, we are currently planning what we're calling a clean energy cluster forum, which will hold in mid-April. We're currently identifying the specific date, but that will be an opportunity for representatives from each of those clusters, industries from around the state, to come together, meet with the governor's office, meet with agency directors, and really have a chance to tell us what it is that they need to be competitive. The key focus will be answering the question, what do you need to be the best in the world in your industry? What do you need to grow your presence in Oregon, but also your reputation internationally? And then it'll be up to the agencies working with those clusters to respond to those needs and to develop some specific action plans and start implementing those. This builds off of work that we did with the Oregon Business Plan, both prior to the summit and at the Leadership Summit in December. We did focus groups around the state, meeting with some of those clusters to begin asking the questions about what their needs are. It was a broader emphasis, so it included both those sustainable clusters, but also a much broader group of industries. And they began identifying some action items. They began mapping out some strategies. This April meeting will really be the opportunity to take that to the next level. And we're also working on a multi-agency policy option package. Again, taking the spirit of interagency collaboration and really driving that into the structure of what we bring to you, the legislature, in 2009, so that we're presenting not one-off budget packages, but one collaborative package that really helps move the ball for industries and for the agencies across the board. We'll also be hosting the next Full Policy Academy meeting in April, which will give us an opportunity to showcase all of the work that we're doing for the other states in the project. And Claire's already spoken to some of the workforce implications. And with that, I will go ahead and turn it over to Duncan.
Wow. Nice job, Marion.
That really summarized, this beautifully. Members of the committee, Chair Witt, my name is Duncan Wise. I'm president of the Oregon Business Council. It's really a pleasure to be here. I would just say wonderful partners in this enterprise. I'm really appreciative of the work the governor, OECD, Oregon Inc., and played in this. And I would tell you, having been doing this for about 20 years, I really do think we are aligned better right now than any time I've ever seen in Oregon. We have an enormous opportunity on economic development to really position the state to successfully secure strong clusters. And so what I'd like to do is just briefly remind you why this is so important, what the basic strategy is, and then talk about what I think is different right now and what the opportunity is. I am responsible for the Oregon Business Plan, which is a collaborative effort among a variety of different business interests. It's not the Oregon Business Council alone by any means. It's a variety of business associations in partnership with public officials, the legislature, the governor, the U.S. senators, and others, to try to envision a future for Oregon's economy that is attractive, that secures high-wage jobs for Oregon, and then creates a set of initiatives to support that vision. And when this whole process began now over 6 years ago, we did have to come up with a framework for thinking about the economy, and we spent quite a bit of time trying to think, what makes the economy tick, or how do you secure long-term prosperity? And I think it's worth reminding ourselves what that basic picture is, and it is this, that economic growth comes from traded sector firms. That is, those firms that compete with businesses outside our borders and sell their products and services outside our borders. And it's very important to focus on those firms. Traditionally, the forest products, agriculture, recent years high tech, metals, transportation equipment. We know the areas, and those firms are absolutely important for the rest of the economy because they bring in the fresh dollars for the base sector, which might be the government services, the banks, the utilities, and all the rest, the healthcare. So traded sector is very important. The second observation, and this is equally important, is that traded sector firms don't randomly place themselves in places. We tend to specialize. Every region naturally specializes in, and the strength of that specialization in product lines and in services is critically important in terms of how well the economy performs in the long term, how high the wages are and how resilient the sectors are. And so it's very important to understand what our specialties are. And that is, if you will, the clusters. And so in Oregon, we're very fortunate to have a range of very strong clusters. And again, the traditional ones, we have wonderful agricultural products, we have a great forestry sector, and again, we've seen a variety of emerging clusters in recent years. The third observation, and this is critically important, is that while places specialize naturally, if you focus on the specialization, if you focus on those clusters and learn what their needs are and talk deeply with the participants in the clusters, we can identify ways to make them more productive in a variety of ways. One is helping industry participants connect with each other. They don't always talk with each other, I will tell you, from the business side. We just bringing business leaders together to talk about common interests is very important. Because, frankly, it's not a natural act for many of them, and they don't, they're very often very competitive with each other. But bringing them together to think about the place and what we can do to make this place more competitive for the group as a whole is very important. And second, we can also find ways to connect them with resources in the community, including public resources. And if we do that systematically and well, we're likely to make them more productive and effective and competitive. That's the basic idea of the Oregon Business Plan, and one that's now embraced by the governor, the state agencies, and again, collaboratively, we're working on that together. So I think that's very important. So with that in mind, what we have done over the years is a series of interviews and focus groups with the clusters, and what you have in the resource guide here is the latest rendition. We've been doing this throughout the process. And we ask, when we go through these cluster focus groups, we start asking them what their challenges are. We talk about your industry. What are the challenges of competing in a global market? And then we ask them, what do you need in terms of community resources to be more successful? And those inevitably come up into two broad categories. One is the big stuff, the big policy issues that, you know, that we you deal with all the time: education, transportation, healthcare. And then, in addition, we get the industry specific items like green buildings want to talk with building codes. The forest sector wants to talk to green buildings to talk about, LEED certification standards. Almost everybody wants to talk with Claire and Cam about workforce issues because it's critically important. Many folks want to talk to Marion and Oregon Inc. on research and development. They have very specific needs that they want to connect with, along with the big needs for a stronger business climate. And through these focus groups, which this round we did jointly, and I stress this, with the Governor's Office, Oregon Inc., OECD. We did these together. We learned a whole lot about what their needs are, and then we captured it in this resource guide, and then took those groups to the summit last year to try to connect them with some of the key resources, including many of you, the legislature, to help them get connected with people who can make a difference in their cluster. So that's the process. What I am so excited about is that we are now in a systematic way committed to carry this forward with the Governor's Office and state agencies so that we can build those set of relationships to learn what the cluster needs are, connect them with key resources across state government and, frankly, local government in the future to help industry leaders get connected. So it's a very promising opportunity. We have selected this group of clusters to work with more intensively, but I would stress that this strategy involves all clusters in connecting with them, and you're seeing that across state agencies. The final observation, again, you can tell I'm really excited about this, is again the role of the legislature. When we talk to members in the industry, I mean, they really do appreciate the time you spend with them and learn your efforts to learn what their needs are. And as we go forward in legislative processes, both formally and informally, really encourage you to stay connected. I mean, if you have clusters you're particularly interested in, you want to specialize as legislators on particular areas and learning needs, it's very helpful. Again, it's a lot about relationships, understanding the specific needs and making sure that we are connecting well with the industry leaders. If we do that well across both the executive branch and the legislative branch, I think for the economy it will make us much stronger. And I will, one final word, for economic development and the Economic Development Department, Bob's doing a great job organizing. It does require us to think differently about the role of the department. It's a role of connecting, relationship building. It's very hard to measure, and it's really important. And so I just, as you think about the department's role, this role of providing glue to help bring people together to understand common interests is an area that's terribly important and very hard to quantify and create specific performance measures. So as you look to the department and its role, I just would encourage you to think about those issues. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Witt, members of the committee. I didn't want to come and interrupt Duncan. He was on quite a roll. As he was talking, though, he was using words that Marion also used and Director Repine used and Ms. Berger used, and I jotted them down because they are part of the reason that community colleges and workforce development are also an integral part. That's one of the words. alignment, focus, aggregate need and demand, and a systematic approach. We actually, I was thrilled to be invited to join this team. It wasn't initially thought that there was as close a connection as we began our planning and trying to look at a strategic focus, that it was like, well, yes, we really need community colleges and workforce development and really all of education at the table as we talk about, as Duncan laid out, once you know what these industry clusters really want, you want a way to be able to respond and not say, oh, we'll get back to you on that, but to actually say, no, this is what we can do in order to assist and ameliorate whatever barriers are in the way. And that's part of the response, is a collective and connected community college response for the industry demand or the cluster demand. And as Claire indicated earlier, the Future Workforce Needs Report does point out that there are cross-cutting skills across many industries that we're going to concentrate our effort on connecting those to these clusters. So it's just a really, you would wonder why something that seems so logical took an NGA academy to bring us all together, but sometimes it just takes some catalyst to get everybody at the table talking about and really focusing. What we did when we went to Chicago is we had to make tough choices because we can't be all all people and be successful in this kind of an effort. So it was that focus, 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 and now that we have found a focus, then it's aggregating all of our responses in a way that's beneficial to that cluster. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I don't know if, and maybe Cam could answer, I don't know, but success stories. Do we have anything to point to for the work that's been accomplished so far? And I, you know, maybe that's in, Claire, maybe that's in the form of...
Well, you mean in terms of...
Successful clusters, maybe, and job creation
goodness.
And development out of it. And
I think we can both probably talk a little bit about that, don't you think? There are some really interesting things going on in many parts of the state. Chair Witt and Representative Huffman, and around in your area, which you could probably talk about very well, having to do with the wind turbine group, the cluster that's formed on the gorge. It's doing very well. Columbia Gorge Community College is kind of the premier institution for developing training and actually cranking out those technician level, very important occupations for this industry and the growth of that industry. It actually connects really well with our kind of clean energy focus we're trying to use. The other piece that I'm thinking about also in the Columbia Gorge area is a cluster of wine growers who are also coming together, and these clusters tend to kind of be spotted all over the state. We have a lot going on in the Yamhill County area. A lot going on in the Bend area around wine clusters, and also just generally some of the new kind of organic food kind of things. There's a cheese group that is happening in, I believe, in Marion County, but there are also other things happening, and I think Duncan has some ideas too.
Well, just briefly, and there are lots. I mean, I'll give a range of them. Food processors. They very early on came in the business plan, embraced this idea, and have really reorganized their whole association around, you know, stronger cluster-based strategy, including productivity initiatives. There's an initiative they presented to Oregon Inc., which was funded to help improve productivity. Again, they are much more strategically focused on opportunities, including, again, making a presentation to Oregon Inc. So, if you will, a traditional industry where this is happening. The other extreme would be wave energy, again, making a proposal to Oregon Inc., now funded, now with lots of research. And I think that's, you know, if you're looking 10, 20 years down the road, I think wave it could be a great example. And everything in between. Each of the clusters you see in this book has taken steps on everything from branding to education to workforce. But I would also tell you that I think the promise is still ahead. I mean, it takes a while to organize, and we've been at this several years. But I think the real promise is as we build and deepen these relationships, we will strengthen the connections across a variety of clusters. I'm sure Marion has more.
Can I just say one other thing? We're all kind of excited about clusters, as you can tell. But there's some surprises out there too. When we were in Medford, the Medford area, it was really interesting. We came across a heavy lift helicopter cluster, which was a very much a news for us. We didn't know it was down there. There are three or four of these companies, and then their supply chain involved. This particular cluster has 95% of the market share in the U.S. of working with FEMA and some of the emergency related. These are huge. I mean, when we say heavy lift helicopters, these are heavy lift helicopters that actually kind of move, provide emergency services, you know, kind of move buildings and this kind of thing. So there are surprises that are coming out that we are really looking at, starting to move forward, and they're there. We don't create them. We just find where they are, we identify them, and try and help move them the next step.
Claire?
Yeah.
Yes, Representative
Chair Witt, thank you. And Marion, I don't want to cut you off, but just something that Claire had touched on. Do you deal with the global niche of clustering, or do you get into dealing with specific businesses?
That's a great question. And actually, the example I was going to use in some ways addresses the question, but if it doesn't fully, we can take another shot at it. The solar cluster is a great example where, based really in the last 6 months, we've identified that in Oregon, because we have a small tech industry base, Intel, Hewlett-Packard, a lot of the semiconductor industry is located here. We've got trained workforce with expertise that's very applicable to photovoltaics in the solar industry. And so by identifying that and by identifying that there's a global trend towards renewable sources of energy, we've been able to, with the governor's leadership, do some very successful recruitments in the past 6 months just by reaching out nationally and internationally to companies to say, we know you want to expand in this area, and we've got exactly the workforce you need right in Oregon. We've also got university strengths through the ONAMI, the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute. They're doing research related to photovoltaics, again, based on that background in semiconductors. And so we've been able to attract significant solar industry players here. So mm-hmm. Part of that cluster work is, yes, working with individual businesses to identify and respond to needs, but it's also identifying, based on the relationships, the workforce, the infrastructure we already have here, where could we use that as an international recruiting opportunity?
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
The size of businesses, are you talking to everything from 20 new employee businesses to 200, or mm-hmm. Just all across the board?
Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, we're talking about the full gamut. Actually, we're talking about very small companies, two or three people, on up to very large companies. It could be Esco Corporation, it could be Freightliner, it could be a variety of these folks. So we're talking about the gamut. I think the piece that's interesting is the clusters in the rural communities. It's an approach that works very well in rural communities, because what a business can do, a single small business can do singly, can be kind of tangentially just expanded when you have three or four companies together. Their ability to work together, their ability to actually be heard and advocate for things is incredible. And we have national and international examples, as well as what we have here in Oregon, to show that this is just an incredibly compelling and dramatic way to really kind of set off some of these local economies, which in turn make our larger economy better, because of course that's where the economy happens, is in the regions.
Continuing that train of thought, probably three or four more questions if I could be. Funding mechanisms. Are there funding mechanisms in place that do these companies ever say, I could do this, I would come if mm-hmm. I could get $50,000 in assistance, or not just tax credit assistance? I know that's very common, but sources of revenue or sources of financial capital.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huffman, yes, there are resources available. They're not plentiful, but they're available. And one of the pieces I want to add is the structure that we're working on and the structure we're talking about today is not designed solely for the idea of attracting a new business here. Quite frankly, I believe that the framework for our thinking has to be built around, how do we enhance and improve the current businesses we have here? How do I turn a two-person business to a 10-person business? If you build that sustainable base through cluster thinking, you will then create an even bigger welcome mat to companies who would be eager to come here to build onto that. So I don't want anybody to believe that this is a recruitment strategy just for bringing those other companies in. Clearly, at the end of the day, if we never brought another company in, the benefactors of this effort will be Oregon businesses that are here today and continually will be in Oregon today.
I'm glad you brought that up, Bob. Because, I mean, I was guiding you to this. I'm curious. You're my pawn. No. How have you been able to assist people this past year without the Regional Rural Investment Program? Funding the Mount Hood Alliances of the state. How have we been able to give loans and grants?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huffman and committee members, regional rural investments that have taken place over the last year have played a very important role in the success of business opportunities or economic opportunities in the 13 regions they represent. There's no doubt about it. Each one of you have received an inventory list of their investments that they've made over time in the last 12 months. And while sometimes you look at a couple of them and say, I don't understand the importance of it, as a whole, you'd find that they have made very strategic investments to put their skin into the game to either offer an existing business in their community the opportunity to expand by offering resources from them, a little from the county, let's say, some from the state of Oregon, through other funds that the governor might have, through a partnership with our community colleges. So when you cobble it all together, there might be 8 to 10 funding streams that will be offered to any business. And depending on what the business is trying to accomplish, those funds are different in value. But the regional investment boards' investments clearly at the they really are the we value you, we want you to be part of this community, to maintain a presence in this community, and for what little money we do have, we're willing to invest that with you because we believe this is a good investment. So that kind of starts the trigger of then that rolls from there up into other investment opportunities to the state and so you know, other places where resources could be found. And so, you know, they become the catalyst of many of the business, particularly retention and expansion of existing businesses. Now, that doesn't to say that they don't invest in other businesses wanting to come in. I know of a couple where they've invested money to entice or to encourage a hospital to relocate in their area because they believe medical health issues are huge. Mm-hmm. And while we might not think of those as a traded sector position to rural communities, having a hospital means the difference between having a community or not having a community because people who live there want to have some services. So they make that investment, and that might be the only investment they get. But it's an investment of consideration that entity sees that the community really values what they are going to bring to that community.
With funding being cut in the 07 session for regional rural, where are we guiding these people to? Where would we tell Mike and John Day, that was a displaced timber worker that had a better idea for a bowstring archery, today, because of a regional rural, I think it was a $50,000 grant, has a factory in John Day employing 43 people, $1.2 million in 07 in payroll, expects 25% growth this year. That would not have been possible without that grant. Where do we send him today?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Huffman and committee members, that investment was extremely important. At the same time, my department, Economic and Community Development, also invested in that company, expanding those opportunities there. So what happens now is we lose that starting catalyst piece, where the regional investment boards currently don't have those resources to make those investments. My field staff are there standing with those regional investment boards still discussing what can we do to help, realizing they turn their pockets inside out at this point in time. They don't have any money. But my business development officers would then take the initiative and say, well, you can come to the agency. We have microenterprise loan opportunities. We have some startup loan opportunities. We have some expansion fund opportunities for you. We will walk miles with those customers trying to put together the resources necessary to try to accomplish what they're looking to complete at the end.
So have the efforts been shifted from regional to state?
Yeah, I think the absence of, Mr. Chairman, Representative Huffman, committee members, I think what we've lost now is that local economic buy-in. It now is defaults to the state because we become the next, or the county, let's say, because sometimes the county could have some money or some resources they might put into it. based on what's going on in many of those rural counties, those are the last places where you're going to find any, what you call it, disposal resources. But we then step in and try to be the best partner we can be with those community partners in encouraging or enticing businesses to expand and to maintain their presence in those communities. But there's a piece that's missing. There's no doubt about it. And I actually, when we testified in the last session, I was asked that very question by a member. Will it change how we do business? And you can't not think that when you have 13 economic partners out there participating with you at some level, that when they're no longer able to participate or can't participate, it has an effect on how you do business. Now, it hasn't stopped business, but I can arguably tell you just in theory, it has changed the way we do business a little bit.
I guess I'm just flabbergasted at the good work that you guys are doing to miss that piece of the puzzle, and I just don't hear that drum being beat from the governor's office or Ways and Means or any place else. I've kind of felt like the lone drummer out there this past year saying, what are we doing? We're doing all the work that you guys are doing, but we're missing a major piece of that funding. And okay, I'll get off the soapbox. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just make a final response to Representative Huffman. Representative Huffman, I think the governor's alliance and allegiance to the regional investment boards was stood very tall and proud in the 07 session when he, in fact, supported the request for the funds and had that built into his governor's recommended budget. So I don't think that has deviated at this point in time.
And I think, too, Bob, there are folks that you've placed regionally that do pay attention to the local scene and are able then to act as a transmission to bring that to the attention of the folks at the state, so that even though we have a much bigger pond to swim in for all these fish, we still do have that direct local input.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. In the absence of the ability for our regional investment board, they're still in the field. And they still, if you remember, members, you funded them to maintain their own operations, so they're staffed to be there, so they're able to work as informational and to work still with my field people to get opportunities available to companies that are either there or wanting to expand opportunities. So they're still in the field. What they don't have, basically, is they don't have any new grant or loan money that they could make available to those companies. But as a presence, as an economic component or partner, they still exist in the community and work much closer today, probably because of the fact they don't have the other resources with my business development officers.
Thank you. I have Vice Chair Lim next, followed by Representative Holvey. And Vice Chair Lim, I apologize. We've lost a couple of our panel members since you stepped into the queue earlier here. So I hope that I didn't allow you to miss the opportunity to ask your question or make your comment.
I don't think you have missed me here. Okay. Anyway, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
Again, going back to the cluster issue, thank you very much for the information you are giving us. Such as a company, the Nike and Intel, the mega companies, you know, they have their own R&D and international, local, nationwide. Why do they need any cluster issue in here? Do you think clusters more for the medium, small companies getting together, or actually it is also helpful to the national, international mega industry, such as I mentioned? And also, just another questions follow up. Is the cluster issue, it seems to me, in the last 4 or 5 years, always this is the key word, the cluster. Mm-hmm. And is this a state-driven the policy, or the industry-driven, or is it combined together? And I'd appreciate responding to my questions.
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, in terms of the large companies getting involved in clusters, Intel, for instance, was involved in fact, when I was in economic development in the early 90s, we helped organize Intel within a larger semiconductor wafer fab group that had about 13 companies. I think Intel is still part of a bit of a smaller group since we had a rather a dip in semiconductor activity. But they found it very important. We had small companies and large companies in this particular cluster. They all found it very important to look at workforce. That was their major focus in looking at pooling their not only their resources to develop a collective training for all of their employees. So they actually reduced the amount of money they actually put into training in HR. But interestingly enough, they actually were able to, when one or two companies took a dip and had to lay people off, some of the other companies were able to come in and be able to take advantage of the labor pool. So in effect, it really did end up and continues to be there. They're still in operation after all these years, and they continue to have this relationship that's ongoing. The other piece is a lot of different clusters start out with some major large companies, and then they start bringing in their supply chain. So typically their supply chain may be very small, depending if it's manufacturing. You may have two or three fairly large companies as the primary focus of the cluster, but you may bring in some other kind of small machine shops. You may bring energy companies, a variety of different kinds of folks involved in the cluster. So that the advantage is that you can, having identified the cluster, which basically we don't identify, they self-identify. We don't go in and say, oh, by the way, you're part of this cluster, so let's meet. They actually have relationships that we simply take advantage of, and we help move forward and try and maximize. So is that it really is driven, although we're looking at a state-driven targeted industry piece with our sustainable clean energy to help grow that particular set of industries and ultimately then see expansion of these industries in the regions. We see the cluster concept being very specific to the communities in which these businesses reside.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, if I might, for Representative Lim, a good example possibly of, you know, everybody, I think, if you think of a cluster as an organization, every person who comes to an organization comes to an organization for something of interest that is important to them. Sometimes it's a lot of things, sometimes it's very minimal things. Just recently, here in the greater Marion County area, there was a company that was closing. So they put an announcement up that they were shutting down. It was an ag business. They were changing up their process, or their parent company was no longer in believing it was a viable activity for them. So generally, if that's a standalone company, it's like, okay, folks, today you're working, tomorrow you're not, and or you'll have so many weeks of severance pay, and we wish you the best of luck. Because of the fact that we have a very strong ag food processing cluster industry in the Marion County area, my business development officer, when he heard this company was going to be terminating these employees, and I think there was an excess of 80 employees, and so it's a large number, he put a contact email out to all the other companies within that cluster, and before the day was over, they had commitments to hire every one of those individuals. Now, it's sad that we lost the company, because that's something we cannot necessarily replace immediately. Hopefully, we'll be able to put somebody else in there. But it kept people working. And it shows that cluster, while it might be a tool for business, also can be a very strong personal tool for the employees to see that their companies are affiliated in these type of relationships, because that doesn't happen too often. And the only way you have that happen is that where you have people who have come together over a period of time, have become trustful in what their business practices are, and they understand their obligation to product and performance, that there wasn't nearly any hesitation to have other companies saying, I'll take 5 of them, I'll take 10 of them, I'll take 20 of them. And by in the matter of a day, all those employees basically were given an opportunity to find employment without any downtime. A small byproduct of cluster, but a very important one from the employee side of what does cluster mean to me? You know, a cluster to them probably means it's something good for the company at the end, you know, at the bottom line. But in this case, cluster played a significant role in maintaining some integrity and quality of commitment to the employees.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to recognize Representative Holby and the fact that Lori Warner, director from our employment department, has joined us, and I will give you an opportunity here in just a minute as soon as Representative Holby's had time to ask his question.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I'm trying to remember what it was. after Representative Huffman's presentation. So and my question has sort of evolved in a couple to a couple of points. You know, I share Representative Huffman's concern about the lack of investments or funding we have available to move our state forward, and clearly last session we had a lot of bills that were predicated on revenues which didn't materialize. It's kind of like we can't have it both ways, I suppose. When, you know, it wasn't that many years ago that corporations and businesses had a tax effort into our state that represented, I believe, 18%. Representative Barnhart probably will correct me because I'm probably off a few, but 18% of our revenues were generated from that those sorts of income taxes, and today they're down below 5%, maybe 4%. And so as we move forward and want to invest in our workforce and our economic development, the lack of those revenues, it really shows up. Having said that, I think that's a policy thing this body needs to address. But I also wanted to, something popped into my mind as we were speaking of the solar, and last session I was really working closely with Mr. Repine on a solar initiative, which was a policy consideration by this body that was opposed by many, a little bit controversial because it potentially had a minor impact on the construction of public buildings and requiring that they have a set aside, a very small amount, for investment in solar technologies, which also played into the fact of, along with some of our credits that were available, to attracting a large solar manufacturer to this state as being a good consideration. And so I just wanted to point out that there's also some other policy things that we can do as a state other than direct funds and direct expenditures that help attract businesses. And I might also point to one in my neck of the woods where we have invested, you know, in higher education more, and speaking of Onami, which helped attract Invitrogen to our area. Mm-hmm. And they were very attracted to the skill and talent production at the University of Oregon in this particular field. So that investment in higher education, mm-hmm. that policy decision also played a role in attracting industry as well. And now back to my question.
After your presentation.
and it was really aimed at some of the folks that were here previously. Sometimes these policies are troubling when I'm going to lead into this, but we have these workforce demands, and sometimes our policies, for example, had a bill that Representative Dallum and I were both working on, a couple of different apprenticeship initiatives, mm-hmm. Trying to require some job opportunities for apprentices in public construction, for example, and another one that was widely opposed. But I hope that we are able to revisit that. But it strikes me odd that we have a community college system that wants to do all this training, yet on their own public construction, they don't require any sort of job opportunities for apprentices. You know, I didn't get there. But Bob, when we, or anybody perhaps, when we focus on bringing these clusters up and helping them, investing in them. You know, some of our clusters are traditionally low-wage clusters, and when our goal is to bring our state into a higher-wage type of economy, which has been pointed out by the business plan and many of the panels that we've looked at in education, how do we balance that with investing in a cluster that is important because it's a traded sector, you know, business or industry, but yet it doesn't really do anything to help raise the wage levels of the state of Oregon? I mean,
mm-hmm. You can give me a chance to think about it a little bit more.
I'm happy to take a shot at it.
Well, I think we all can take a shot at that.
Chair Witt.
A shot at it, not
me. Oh, not at you, certainly. So Chair Witt, Representative Holby, to speak to that question. It's a combination. I think in targeting some of the clusters, certainly we're trying to identify clusters that already have higher than average wages, but there's also an effort with some of those clusters that do have lower wages to help identify ways that will raise the wage. Food processing is a good example. As an industry, the average wage is below the state average. But some of the initiatives that the state's investing in through Oregon Inc. and through some of the consortium efforts are helping to raise those wages so that you're trying to not only invest in some target areas where you'll help create those higher wage jobs, but you're also helping those industries be more successful so that wages will raise up and get closer to that average.
Mm-hmm. Chair Witt, Representative Holby, I think we also are trying to use kind of a systemic approach to this. Okay. One is that we talked a little bit on Monday or Tuesday about the career pathways model. And that is, you know, moving people up through these different occupations up to that so they continue to gain more skills and then have the ability to gain occupations that are higher wage. And typically what we really want to look at is how we with some individuals they start in a lower wage but they move up. And I think that's what we're really trying to take a look at, is what kind of mechanisms do we have available? What do we need to build in order to make this happen? And I think some of the questions that we have that we'll be taking a look at is, what are the policies? What's the public responsibility? Where's the public dollar need to go here? You know, does it need to go on specifically looking at supporting those higher wage jobs? Does it need to go into moving people up from entry level on up to higher wage jobs? We need to be talking about that in relation to this whole NGA Policy Academy. And the good thing about this, other than we're pretty excited about it, is that we have access to other states and how they're dealing with these issues. So we're hoping we can have lots of different information that is going to kind of be kind of a wraparound package on how this is going to be successful.
Representative Holby, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I think both Marion and Claire have really touched on it, but the piece that I think that you're addressing, and it really I think is more important, we look at it from the entire state of Oregon. We make every effort, and I think we're pretty good at trying to make sure that any jobs that we either invite or recruit or enhance in the state of Oregon, either via an existing company or a company that might be interested in coming here, that we are always playing the making sure that the salary is higher than the mean average in the area, at least by a 50%, 150% of the mean average. So we always do that. And many times we exceed that greatly. And I think that's the key piece. What happens in Hermiston versus what happens in Eugene in pay scale is all relative to cost of living and things of that nature, too. So sometimes when we get involved from this side of the Cascades and doing a recruitment on something that's taking place out in the east, we look at the pay scale and we go, boy, that's really low. Well, you know, we have to be reminded that actually that's a real good paying job in that community. And where we kind of treat it as, you know, gee, shouldn't they be able to do better? We have to put ourselves in their place as that job pertains to them. So we are always trying to figure out a way to improve Oregonians' lives. And we don't, there's nothing in any of our documentation or any presentation you ever see that we're just trying to create jobs. We always talk we're trying to create higher, better paying jobs. And as Claire has mentioned and Mary has mentioned, even the probably the most traditional industry, which is the egg or food processing industry, has been still is a industry with many people of lower incomes, not moderate incomes, let's say, not extremely high incomes. But as technology enters into those fields, as new improved practices of processing add, those become skill up requirements for those people to those same people who were doing the product a year before to be able to accommodate the necessity of what the new elements of that product designs are today. That could involve computers, that can involve much more sophisticated mathematics. And with that, the businesses understand as those people's skills get improved, their skills improve, and their product becomes more valuable, that there is a cost consequence to pay higher salaries for those individuals. And so it doesn't happen overnight, but you can follow this migration of salaries as products are improving and industry techniques are enhanced and product costs are selling higher, and that is getting down to those employees in paychecks at the end of the day.
Additional questions or comments? Lori, welcome.
Good morning, Representative Witt and members of the committee. I'm Lori Warner, the director for the Employment Department. As you can see, this has been a fun team to be part of, and it's obvious the synergy that has occurred in terms of conversations sort of across the spectrum related to these particular issues. The Employment Department's role here, of course, we deal with the economy as it is today on a daily basis from businesses looking to us for employees and job seekers looking for jobs. And so we have a pool of folks that are registered in IMATCH skills that are a source of labor for those who are seeking folks. And we, in terms of participating in this group, if we're going to focus on a particular cluster with particular skill needs, Cam and I would be working jointly at looking at some of the folks we have in that pool, mm-hmm. and then what the opportunity is to move them up through additional training and various kinds of leveraged investment with individuals into perhaps the jobs that the clusters need to have in order to grow their businesses and or locate here. So there's those connections that are made. On the second piece is the department, of course, collects lots of information about both the employers and the employees across the state in our labor market information division that Graham Slater is the administrator of, and I think he spoke to this committee a number of times. So we project what the jobs of the future are going to be in Oregon based on the current economy. These are the emerging jobs, and there's data that we can provide and help use to guide and inform Representative Holvey's question about high wage, high demand. We have identified those across the state by region, so we know what those are, and we work with economic development right now in terms of looking at what those particular jobs are and helping to guide that discussion. So there's lots of opportunity here, I think, as we move forward, and we've appreciated being part of this effort. I think that oftentimes Bob speaks to the fact that businesses don't get together and talk about their clusters, and state agencies and the business community sometimes need something like this to link us together so that we can have those conversations too and do a better job for all of the Oregonians.
Thank you very much. Laura, you mentioned IMATCH, and
yes.
For the benefit of our television viewers, would you briefly describe the IMATCH system, please?
Certainly. The IMATCH skills system is basically a job registration where job seekers come in, and in that system, if they're looking for work, they register in IMATCH, and it's an online system. They can do that either in one of our offices or from a home computer or from anywhere they might be. And basically what happens is those skills that they identify in IMATCH are then cross-match to skills that job listings are seeking, and then they are matched to job openings that way across the system. So it is available to folks 24/7 to register and for businesses to put their jobs in also and identify what skills they're looking for in terms of the job requests that they have to fill.
And you have a large number of employers that are part of that system?
Yes, and they're both large and small. It's open. It's universal access, so it is open to all Oregon businesses, and it is open to all job seekers. So depending on the economy and what's going on in terms of unemployment and et cetera, unemployment recipients are required to register in IMatch to be able to draw their unemployment check. Because our intent is to put them in the next job, help them find that. So there's a significant pool of job seekers and businesses that are using that system right now.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'll just kind of summarize, and if there's any other questions, we'll answer them. If not, we'll move on to the next agenda. What I'd like to leave you with is, first of all, I want to make a statement that everybody understands. Well, we've, in the slideshow that Marion showed you and the information that we've handed to you, we've indicated certain industries that we're kind of building this structure around. I don't want any of you leaving here to believe that we have taken every other industry opportunity that may not be appearing on that list and saying we're not involved in that. We are as eager to invite business opportunities for expansion or recruitment, whatever it might be, in all fields of business for Oregon. What we've tried to do is pick a very specific group of activities that we believe, from the information we learned from the Academy, that are growing economic opportunities for this state, where we either are current leaders or show a presence of being a future leader for a long period of time. If you think about this, and that list of items that Marin had on her slide, it complements, interestingly enough, from those monitor group analyses of these type of industries, to much of the work that you and this assembly has invested in Oregon Inc. You invested in WAVE. You've invested in the BEST program, which is sustainable technologies. You've invested in research opportunities that complement much of these industries we're chasing. So all of a sudden, you know, the lights turned on where it was, okay, the legislature is putting seed money in for business opportunity, creating business opportunities here, incubating them here in Oregon. How do we take that and move that to something that we can maintain and control and enhance so it becomes an Oregon business or an expansion of a business as opposed to them going somewhere else? And how can we then take all the components that make business successful, whether it need for workforce, whether it's need for better communications, if it's regulatory conformity, whatever those things are, how do we work with those industries to help resolve those issues, to address their needs so they can grow? We're not going to make those industries grow, but we have an amazing amount of tools available to all of us that help them be successful. And I think that's the focus of this. So this is not turning our back on any other industry, but it's really just kind of highlighting some industries today. If, in fact, this model becomes successful, and I believe it will, then it becomes the norm of how we'll do business in all industries in the future. One of the things that I think I learned, and I share this with my staff, and I'll share this with you, and I think it's a great way to it was a very humbling effect to go to the NGA forum for me, because we were asked effectively to bring two pieces of paper. One piece of paper that said, give us what you believe is the selling points of your state. Mm-hmm. Livability, quality of life, transportation, sustainability. You know, we've all run that down in our mind, what we believe Oregon represents. Good education system, high university technology, whatever it is. And then the other piece of paper is, what are the cluster industries you have that you believe are your really maximizers of economic opportunities? And you listed them. Food processing, technology, sportswear. Go down the list of the 12 or so that we have and the ones we've mentioned here. There were six other states throughout this event with us. If you took, this is, again, what I've told my staff, if you took all of our two pagers, cut the letterhead off of each one of them, put them on a table, mixed them up, and asked anybody to pick theirs out, you couldn't, because they all look the same. So what we're learning from the NGA is we think we look different from ourselves' perspectives. We don't. It really is now the challenge, how do we really identify ourselves in a different way to become a state that will garner the attraction of potential businesses coming here, or businesses who are here today who don't realize the opportunities that they have not even started to discover yet with their own state. So it's a marketing opportunity. It's a way to reframe how we do business in Oregon. It's a way to bring together some, again, Mary mentioned this. No other state was there with the cadre of people that we had. They absolutely look at us and say, you can actually bring state agencies together and talk about something? They think this is absolutely absurd, or unique, if nothing else.
Maybe absurd, yeah.
And we in Oregon, I think those who have been around long enough, have realized we have done this well. Probably one of the best examples that I can share with you, and many of you are aware of it, is the Oregon Economic Revitalization Team effort that's been going on since the formation of Community Solutions, which goes back almost 8-9 years now. We are very successful at that, and we have successes after successes in every one of those communities that we've worked in. This is, if you think about it, is just a hybrid of that type of team thinking. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't Lori and I sit down and talk about things on a common level about what do you have to help offer relative to economics, and what can I do to invite the type of businesses that you have on a matrix list that says this is where your industry opportunities are in these communities? Why shouldn't I be looking at her list to say, I know now what this region needs, and that's where we can help fill in those voids? At the same time, she can say, if you're recruiting a company here, and this is what they're looking, this is what I can help offer in the way of in workforce opportunities. Same with CAM. I mean, the opportunities here are just unlimited. And I would tell you, probably the most exciting times for Oregon in its economic future are ahead because of some of what will be. This won't be the end-all, do-all for all the issues around economic development and growth of Oregon, but this is a huge turning point in how we do business in Oregon. So we're happy we were able to share it with you, and if you have any other questions, we'll be happy to take those.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this presentation. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. My area, along with the other representative who's on your group, David Edwards, we have one of the longest live clusters around, and it's been extremely successful, and I want to thank you for your efforts there, because it really shows in our district, and I think it will show very well with your efforts around the state. And also, I think of what you guys do as very unique and attacking problems from unique perspective, and therefore I think of you more of knights than pawns. And I want to thank you all very much for your efforts.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yes, Vice Chair Lim, please.
Thank you very much. And as I hear from you, that the Bob seems to me state government integrating and working together pretty well, and which I understand. But at the same time, we have another layer of a city and county and a metro, and how do you get through with them? Because they are all the regional independent and the government and locally. And I'm hearing from the constituents some frustration that when they try to work out, they kick each other, and it takes a long time to resolve. And how are you going to do those things?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lim, committee members, I think the best way to characterize your answer your question is by saying that the table we sit at can have other leaves added to the table and other chairs drawn up to the table. And as we go into communities, as we follow the leads of economic opportunities, be it existing businesses or retention or expansion, whatever it might be, or recruitment, there are elements that will involve local government, either the city or the county. We as a team, I think, all of us fundamentally believe, because it's the way we do our work, have learned to do our work together now, we will, if we find that as an example in Mr. Weiss's document where he talked about some of the barriers some of the industries are found. Now, if maybe a barrier there is relative to something that's going at the county, in many cases it has to do with some land use issues, and that's, so you'd arguably say that's owned by the counties. We'll be happy to put another leaf on the table, pull up another chair, and have that invite the county and all those other partners to come down and sit with us to figure out how do we get to something that will, at the end of the day, fundamentally people will believe will benefit their community, and realize that there's things we're going to have to do to work out the differences that keep those opportunities from happening. So we will. This won't be a limited table setting. It will be an expanded table setting where needed we bring in the right partners and the right participants to address those type of issues that only come about after we sit down and start having our first discussions.
Thank you very, very much. And Bob, as we're looking at setting the community block grant development right. program table, are you going to key that
one? I am. I'll wait for thank you, folks, for coming.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to change over on another presentation. Many of you are aware of community development block grant funds in your communities. We manage that for the federal government. We manage the unentitlement areas. So if in metropolitan areas, Eugene, Portland, larger communities that have larger populations manage their own CBDG funds, so those are entitlement areas. We manage the other part of the state of Oregon. So most of rural Oregon are areas or populations or community centers that are less than 50,000 in population. Mary Baker, who sits on the right-hand side sitting at the keyboard, is our manager, our community development block grant program. Mary's been involved in this activity. I asked her on the way over. I said, how long have you been doing this, Mary? And between both the local involvement with CBDG and state involvement with the same program, she's been doing this over 15 years. So she is kind of the certified expert. She is well respected in the national market of community development block grant activities. She's called on many times to come back in East particular and make presentations. She's a delightful person, knows this backwards and forwards. Again, a program that I think is extremely valuable to our Oregon economy. Ann Hannes, who's sitting directly next to me, manages the community development programs, of which CBDG is one of those programs. We thought it would be interesting. We made this presentation to our Economic Development Commission here a couple months ago. They found it very interesting because they had not had that kind of exposure to the community development block grant program generally in their normal discussions. And we thought it would be of interest to all of you, and because it's something that's a very timely at this point in time, because I talked to the chair about some of the opportunities that we will be able to use these funds to help with some disaster relief that the chair has had come about in his region. But it is a huge economic tool for communities, for those grant funds that you need to pull together activities that are the centerpiece or lifeblood of your community growth. So I'll let Mary go on from there, and we'll be interested in seeing what questions you might have. Or Ann, sorry.
We're having a bit of technical difficulty. Oh, we got it on there. Great.
Thanks to Vice Chair Riley, who jumped right on it. I think we're underway here.
For the record, I'm Ann Hannes, Manager of Community Development Division. I'd also like to recognize Christine Valentine. She is our expert in community development block grant. She has been putting a lot of time recently into working on the disasters and looking at ways to use CDBG that way. CDBG is...
Ann, if I could interrupt, excuse me, just for a second. Committee members and audience members, if anyone has a communication device that's on, that's probably the feedback that we're hearing. So.
Okay. Great. Okay. Community Development Block Grant is extremely important to many of your communities, especially those that are rural and also low and moderate income, because it provides grants for economic and community development projects, things like water and sewer projects, downtown redevelopment, senior citizen centers, daycare centers. It also provides revolving loan funds. What you're also going to hear from Mary is that the Community Development Block Grant is one of the rare programs that actually can act as a match to FEMA funds. So this can be really important to those communities that are hit by disasters as well. So with that, I'm going to have Mary start her presentation.
Okay. Good day, Chair Witt and representatives. Thank you for having me here today.
Well, thank you for appearing before
us. I think this is the first time we have ever brought the CDBG program before a group, so
welcome.
I think this is great.
Actually, Mr. Chairman,
we do too.
When she said that, it wasn't just in reference to just the last few years. I asked Mary on the way over here, had she ever actually appeared in front of the Legislative Assembly in her 13 years working in this for the state of Oregon, making this presentation. She indicated she had never made this presentation. So you are a group of people over the last 13 years who have never heard this presentation.
Well, and long overdue. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Well, today what we're going to do is we're going to present to you a little bit about the past, present, and future of the state of Oregon's non-entitlement CDBG program. And I will define non-entitlement momentarily in the next few slides for you so you know what that means. And I really have tried to limit the use of acronyms today. And so if I use an acronym that you do not understand, please call it to my attention so I can let everybody know what it means, okay? And CDBG stands for Community Development Block Grant, and I will be saying that one a lot. Okay. To understand the program, we need to understand the past of the program. From 1975 to 1981, HUD conducted an annual competition annually to the cities in order to administer the program. And they actually hand-administered each program nationally and each grant nationally. In 1981, as one of the outcomes of the Reagan administration, they decided that states needed more local control over these funds in order to meet their state needs. And so what they did was they amended the Housing and Community Development Act, which is also known as HCDA, to allow states more authority in implementing the program. And what this did is now the states could actually administer the program on HUD's behalf. By 1982, 37 states had taken over the program from HUD, of which Oregon was one at this point in time. But by 1987, 49 states had taken over the program from HUD, with the exception of Hawaii, and Hawaii still does not have the program. Now, the contract that we have with HUD is very unique in nature in the fact that whoever signed that grant agreement with HUD or the agreement with HUD to administer the program in 1982 signed the state away for life. We cannot give the program back to HUD. We are quasi-HUD staff. We are their arm in Oregon. So if we don't like the program, we're still stuck with the program. Okay? And one thing that HUD does is they fully expect us to administer this program in full compliance with the federal regulations. If the state has non-performance in the administration of this program, what they will do is they will either sanction the state or reduce our future allocations. So in changing roles from HUD administering the program to the state administering the program, HUD now just monitors the states to ensure that we are administering the program in compliance with the regulation, and now it is the state's responsibility to actually establish the design of the program, the funding requirements, and those funding requirements are actually prepared and developed in what's called the Method of Distribution, or MOD, you'll hear me refer to, selecting how we select our grantees, financial management, record keeping, reporting, monitoring, closeout, and ensuring compliance by our grantees. As I stated earlier, I was going to define non-entitlement for you. The state is restricted in making grants to any area which is considered an entitlement area. Entitlements receive their own direct allocations from HUD. If they receive their own direct allocation from HUD, they are not eligible to receive funds underneath the non-entitlement program. In order to be an entitlement city, the city must be 50,000 or more in population, and they must make application to HUD to receive those funds. The current cities in Oregon, which are entitlements, are the cities of Ashland, Bend, Corvallis, Eugene, Gresham, Hillsboro, Medford, Portland, Salem, and Springfield. Now, counties have the very same restriction, but the population limit is 200,000. So if a county has a population of 200,000 and has made application to HUD and are receiving their own direct entitlement, they cannot receive funds underneath the state's non-entitlement program. The current entitlement counties are Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas. Now, tribes also receive their own direct entitlements from HUD. It's called the Indian CDBG program, or ICDBG. So they are also not eligible to apply underneath the state's program. However, we can participate on on projects located on tribal land. For example, if there's a sanitary district that serves tribal members and non-tribal members, we can participate in the project on a prorated basis to be at the same level of participation from the non-tribal members. The The State of Oregon's program year is January 1st through December 31st in our method of distribution. And HUD requires us to prepare many reports to them on the accomplishments and the outcomes of what we have done with their funds. And some of the reports that we have, I have up on the screen for you, is we have the five-year consolidated plan, which usually involves 10 to 15 public participation meetings statewide. The plan is a general plan identifying the needs around the state and how the CDBG program may be able to meet those needs. The state is currently underneath the 2006-2010 consolidated plan, and the next five-year consolidated plan is due to HUD 45 days prior to the next five-year cycle beginning, which is by November 15th of 2010. In addition, the state is also required to prepare an analysis of impediments to fair housing and a fair housing action plan. The plan we are currently under is also dated 2006 to 2010. We also have to prepare our annual action plan update, or which is also our method of distribution. Again, it's this big purple book here that we give to all of our applicants. And what that book does is every year we have to specifically decide which activities we're going to fund for that year, how much money we're going to set aside for them, what the maximum grant amounts, the application criteria, and all the application forms have to be developed. Everything has to be publicly disclosed. And so that is what is contained within our method of distribution. And again, that has to be prepared each year, and we have to submit it 45 days prior to the beginning of our next program year. So, for example, for our 09 program year, we'll have to submit our 09 method of distribution to HUD by November 15th of this year. The other report that we have is HUD also, not only do they want to know how we plan to use our funds, they want to know what we've done with them down to the penny. So for every grant the state of Oregon has open with HUD, we have to fully account by penny and project what we funded, how much money went into it, what the outcomes were from that project. So that is a huge report that we have to submit each year, and it's due 90 days after the end of the program year or by March 30th or 31st of each year. The federal objective of the program is the development of viable or livable urban communities by expanding economic opportunities, providing decent housing and a suitable living environment, principally for persons of low and moderate income. Now, HUD also has some other special focus areas, which is ending chronic homelessness and hunger for the use of these funds. In order to meet these federal objectives, each project that the state funds is required to meet one of three national objectives. The first one is low and moderate income. And we are federally required by statute that we have to spend 70% of each annual allocation meeting this particular national objective. The second national objective is elimination of slum and blights, and the third one is urgent need. Now, underneath urgent need projects, what we can fund is the repair, replacement, or mitigation of damages that have resulted from a qualifying disaster. This slide represents the federal allocation and the state's annual allocation that we have received for the last several years and the general decline in the amount of funds that have been available for the program. Now, one thing that I do not have on this slide is that the presidential budget revealed for 2009 has a proposed federal CDBG allocation nationally of $2.97 billion. And again, it's early in the process, so that number will change, but that is what is contained in the presidential budget at this point.
This has been a growing concern for us because as that's been steadily declining over the last 5 or 6 years. That means there's fewer grants that we can make to communities. One of the things that Mary has attached in the back of the presentation is a list of those projects that we've heard from communities that they are very interested in, and there's a very high demand for these dollars.
Can you go back to that previous slide so that we can see that decline? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I'm curious, do we know why the federal government is reducing this figure for us for this allocation? Is it simply a function of the national debt, or do we know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holden, committee members, I'll take the question because I don't think my staff wants to take it. My assumption would be that this is a trend that we've been seeing in the last over a series of years with the federal funds because of other federal funds being deferred or detoured to other investments, offshore investments. There are fundamental community programs that are being reduced to augment those cost shifts, and so I think this, amongst many other programs that states participate with the federal government, the decline in those resources is because they're making other investments.
And they think we speak politically.
Pardon me?
I say, and they think we speak politically.
Yeah.
Offshore. Like oil or... thank you.
Okay. Shall I begin again? Okay. Each annual allocation the state receives, we are allowed a certain percentage of that for state administration of the program. The state, by statute, is allowed 2% for state administration, which must be matched dollar for dollar from non-federal funds. Currently, our department uses funds from the Special Public Works Program for this match. In addition, the state is allowed to take $100,000 off the top of each annual allocation for state administration, which does not require a match, 1% for technical assistance projects, and the remaining 96 to 97% must be obligated to projects, again of which 70% of those projects must meet the low and moderate income national objective. The Oregon Economic and Community Development Department has an interagency agreement with Oregon Housing and Community Services. How this works is our department receives the grant, then we subgrant 24% of the annual allocation, which includes both the amount available for projects and state administration, to Oregon Housing and Community Services to manage on our behalf the Housing Rehabilitation Program and the Housing Resource Center program for us. And how this works is we just receive the funds and they administer the program, but we incorporate all of their information into our method of distribution since we're responsible for it. So it's kind of a seamless transfer of the funds. We work very closely together. This interagency cooperation began on September 28th of 2000, and we're underneath a current interagency agreement with them, which ends in 2010.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, committee members, transfer took place in 2000 when I was actually the director of the agency, as many of you know, at Housing. And what the purpose was, as I heard from my legislative members and community partners, that there was a growing need to try to figure out a way to get some resources available to communities for people, particularly as our population is aging, and people, one of their assets, and their, if not only asset they have, is their home. I've always been a firm believer that if you can keep people in their residence and keep them out of the state supplement systems, or such as rest care facilities or assisted living facilities, then the state financially is better off. And it made sense to try to figure out a process where we could create housing resource centers, for lack of a better way to describe, one-stop centers where citizens could come in to their local jurisdiction, local partners, community partners, to acquire or find or inquire about resources to maybe help them with their roof that's leaking now. And as you all know, it's a slippery slope soon when the roof starts leaking or the siding blows off of a house and the person who's in there says, look, I live off of Social Security, I don't have any other resources, I can't fix this, I give up, I'll sell the house. I'll move into something else, and that move usually meant that they would come into something that would be supported by the state of Oregon, which is okay, but we're displacing people in a situation that we might be able to defer or deter that a little bit by assisting them in some use of resources for spending CBDG funds to help them get a roof repaired. So the idea was to try to create a process that was regionalized around the state of Oregon, so people would have a way to find these resources in smaller financial amounts. Didn't have to worry about managing because obviously, as you've heard from Mary, the paperwork on this is immense, but allowing the regional partner be the grant manager for those communities or those individuals in their individual homes. And so it actually has proven to be very successful in the almost 8 years we've been doing it.
Okay, I'm going to now refer you to, if you go past the slides in your handout, it'll be the first page. And what this is it's a table which summarizes all the awards that we have made during 2007, who they went to, and the anticipated accomplishments from each one those projects. They're all grouped up. And in summary, we made 41 awards that will benefit 89, I have a wrong number on the slide, it's actually 89 cities and counties. We will rehab 137 homeowner-occupied units. We'll create 90 jobs. We'll assist 198 micro-enterprises. We'll create 12 beds at a domestic violence shelter. Overall, we will benefit 44,000 Oregonians, of which 26% are going to be considered low and moderate income. We have awarded nearly $13.5 million worth of funds that leverage 6.1 of federal, state, and local funds. We have also funded 6 public water and wastewater systems and 1 downtown revitalization project for the year. So that's the summary of our activities underneath the program for 07.
And again, Mary, what was that leverage, the dollar figure?
$6.1 million.
Very good. Thank you.
Now, as the state changes, sometimes the need changes, and we see it by the applications that we receive in our public participation process. And again, I'm going to have to refer you in your handout, in your packet, to 3 pie charts that you can look at later. And historically, the program has run for many years about 50% on public works, 25 to 30% for community facilities, 20% for housing rehab. And to be responsible to local needs, the state also added microenterprise assistance and economic development a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
However, in 2007, we saw a decrease in public works from 52 to 21%, an increase in community facilities from 19 to 29, economic development increased from 0 to 17, and microenterprise assistance increased from 1 to 4%.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you. Can you tell me what community facilities, what does that entail? What sort of things is that?
Chair Witt and Representative Riley, if I can get 2 more slides down my presentation, I'll be able to answer your question.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Now, one other thing that you'll notice in your packet is the list that Ann referred to. It's a long list that looks like this. Now, what this is this is a proposed list of 2008 anticipated projects that are actually looking at coming to the program in 2008. This is basically a subset of the larger infrastructure inventory that we have pulled, and these are the ones that we are currently working on that staff know about and we are developing for this program for this year. And on this list, you will note that it consists of 38% public works, 41% community facilities, 1% microenterprise assistance, and 20% economic development. And it contains over $41 million worth of projects for our $14 million annual allocation. Okay, our original 2008 method of distribution for the year, these were the funding targets that were identified in it. Now, this program is a competitive application process, and each project competes with like projects. The first and foremost criteria that we rate applications on is the need for the project. The maximum points for this criterion is directly associated with the HUD and state priority that's identified within our 5-year consolidated plan for each project type. In addition, this requires each applicant to take into account how their project fits into the new local infrastructure inventory. And if you refer to handout number 4, it's the last page of your handouts, what you'll see is our actual priorities for the program. Now, the other criterion that applications are rated on is how the proposed solution meets the identified need, the readiness to proceed, financial need, national objective, the number of persons to be served by the facility, and points for no recent awards because we like to geographically distribute the awards as much as possible, and their ability to administer the grant and their capacity to handle this program. The program also contains a minimum point threshold that every project must score a minimum of 70% of the total points for their project type in order to be forwarded to the rating and ranking committee. Now, here's where we have some changes that I need to update you on, and I'll do my best here if I can stretch out just a minute. Okay. One unique feature of this program is it can provide the 25% match needed at the local level for the Federal Emergency Management Agency programs. Because of this feature, We amended our 2008 method of distribution to allow us to expend up to 25% of our fiscal year 2008 annual allocation for disaster recovery in response to the recent disaster. Now, these projects for disaster recovery must meet the urgent need national objective, which means they must be used to repair, replace, or mitigate damages that resulted from the qualifying disaster. On December 18th, our department submitted a letter to HUD requesting several waivers of federal program requirements to make the use of these funds easier at the local level. And on February 1st, we received a letter back from HUD with some approvals for our program. And so our amended method of distribution contains the following changes. The first item is that one of our first waivers is that HUD allow us to expedite our 30-day public participation process at the state level. We were able to lessen that time period down to 3 days. So the 2008 method of distribution was made public on February 8th. Comments were due by February 13th. We allowed a couple extra days because that time period is over a weekend. And so, in effect, our amended method of distribution, which I'm providing the information to you here today, is now in effect. Now, the second item that we received is we received approval of pre-award costs, which allows the state to fund disaster-related emergency projects before receipt of our annual 2008 annual allocation from HUD. And this is a key factor because even though we finally did get our allocation through the omnibus spending bill that the Congress passed, we may not actually receive our grant from HUD till about June. So if we have an application come in right now, we want to be able to fund it. We now have the ability to pre-award these costs. The other item that we received is additional costs for state administration so that we can provide more direct state technical assistance to help the affected communities prepare applications for funding. We also received the use of an entitlement regulation that will allow us to use these funds to purchase equipment that's not fixed and integral, such as pumps, blowers, and other equipment needed to help remediate damage. Again, we were also able to reduce our local citizen participation requirements that our applicants have to prepare and do these public hearings before they submit an application. We would get those reduced so that it takes less time to prepare an application and get it into our door.
The bottom line here, in addition to the flexibility that we increase flexibility from HUD, is that by amending our mod, it frees up $3.3 million directly for emergency. That then leverages that other FEMA dollar. So this is going to be, I think, particularly important to those communities hard hit by the disasters.
Yes.
Okay. One of the other things that we did do in our 2008 method distribution is that as projects close out, we get unobligated funds that we have to recapture that they weren't able to expend on their projects. So we recapture those funds. And we were sitting on a little bit of a pot of money that was unobligated. We set those funds aside in our amended 2008 method of distribution to go for disaster recovery. So out of our fiscal year 08 annual allocation, we'll have about $3.3 million for disaster recovery, but when you add that to our 07 unobligated recaptured funds, it brings the total up to $4.1 million that we will have available for disaster recovery underneath this program. Now, the other thing the state did in response to the disaster is that we worked with the governor's office, and on January 3rd, the governor sent a letter to the congressional delegation requesting a special CDBG disaster allocation for the state of Oregon of $4 million. We do not know the status of that request.
We know that our congressional delegation, however, is working on that. That would require a special allocation through federal legislation.
Okay, our maximum grants per category is economic development is $750,000. This year we funded three of them to Pendleton, Hermiston, and Milton Free Water, and those are used to set up economic development revolving loan funds. We also fund numerous microenterprise assistance projects throughout the state. If you refer to your handout, you'll see that there were seven awards in various communities. Now, Public Works has four different project types. We have Public Works for water and wastewater projects. The maximum grant underneath that is $1 million. We have Public Works for brownfield redevelopment and downtown revitalization. The maximum grant on that is $300,000. We also have off-site infrastructure for new affordable low-income housing, and that maximum grant is $225,000. And then we move into your public/community facilities category, and underneath this category, we have two levels levels of grants. We have $800,000 and $500,000. The $800,000 grants are for those facilities that generally cannot create or generate or receive revenues through taxes. Examples of that is the Columbia County Mental Health Center, the Klamath County Mental Health Center that we just funded, the North Bend Domestic Violence Shelter, a homeless shelter, and senior centers. We require our senior centers to serve 5 meals per week and other various activities. Now, underneath the $500,000 category, these facilities can usually receive some type of revenue through a tax base. And examples of these types of facilities are the fire station that we constructed for Juniper Flat Road Rural Fire Protection District, the Mount Vernon Community Center, and the Oak Ridge Library. We also do our regional housing rehabilitation, our housing resource centers, and new for 2008, we have our downtown facade rehabilitation program. We have not made any awards in this yet because it's brand new. Did that answer your question, Representative Riley and Chair Witt? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, Vice Chair Lynn.
Thank you very much. I'm just curious, is this a block grant? Is this mostly a grant or the matching fund? Do you do any loans also?
We just do grants.
Just grants?
Just grants.
Or matching funds, such as a disaster area?
Yes, yes, but it's still a grant to the community.
Okay, thank
yes.
you.
I would like to add that one area that we have had that interest in and we have made grants for is for communities to establish economic development revolving loan funds. And so they use our grant, establish the revolving loan fund, and establish that loan fund in their community.
Okay. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair White. Can you describe what the downtown facade program would
okay,
who
this
could
is
apply for that and what would it do?
Okay, this is a new category for this year. And cities can apply for it. And what it'll do is it'll help them with their Main Street program. They have to be a certified Main Street program. And we're showing this as our participation in the National Historic Trust Main Street program. And what they can do is they can receive these funds and they can actually do beautification of the facades on the outside of the building only in a certified Main Street area.
Public and private?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huffman, committee members, for the sake of Representative Huffman and Representative Springer, last session the Assembly approved the recreation of the Oregon Main Street program, which is administered by my agency. And with that, the agency was given approximately $500,000 to set up programs to try to invite opportunities for Oregon downtowns or communities to participate to become a certified National Main Street. I'm always out trying to figure out how I can use other people's money. So right after that was approved, $500,000, while it seems is a lot of money, and you start thinking about spreading that around 242 cities that could become main streets, it gets to be a small amount quickly. So what I did was ask other agencies who have programs that could complement the Oregon Main Street program, everybody from state lands, possibly from DLCD, who have growth management programs, to the Department of Transportation, and our own agency. I said, well, if I'm asking other agencies to help me facilitate either find finances they currently have that could be targeted or directed to this activity so we could create a little more leverage, I felt that I'm compelled that I needed to do the same thing for our agency. So what this is my contribution to supporting more resources to make opportunities for Oregon Main Street possibilities in Oregon become a reality. Because one of the criterias of Oregon Main Street and the National Main Street program is that you have to have a design standard, which generally means you have to have some way for businesses to access some resources to help them change their facades back to what the historic presence of those buildings were in when the building was in original state, as opposed to some of the ones who've had veneer put on them over the years. So again, it's a small contribution. It would be a loan program. It wouldn't be a grant program in this case. It would revolve back to the entity that gets the money, and then they could lend it out to somebody else. So it's a piece that we've tried to put together to help complement the Oregon Main Street program that was approved by the Assembly last session.
Okay. In order for a project to be funded, the applicant must be eligible and the project must be eligible. The applicant, of course, must be a non-entitlement city or county. They must not have more than 3 open grants with our agency, and those grants must be meeting certain expenditure and drawdown requirements so that we can see that they are proceeding on time. And they must not have any unresolved performance issues, such as if we've gone out to monitor them, they don't have a lot of federal findings or violations on their prior grants. And again, the project must be eligible in that it must meet the federal national objective, one of them, and it must meet all the criteria contained in our method of distribution for that particular project type. What I would like to note is that emergency projects do not have to meet all of the applicant eligibility requirements. They only must be needed to be submitted by a non-entitlement city and county. Now, our application process is a quarterly competitive process which was developed in close cooperation and coordination with the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties.
Mary, due to time constraints, if I could ask you to please just summarize the remaining slides, it would be very helpful.
Okay, I will go just as fast as I can.
All right, thank you.
And basically what we do, we just rate and rank all applications. They go before a board. They get rated and ranked by one group. They go before a board of senior management, which also consists of AOC and LOC. Those applications then are their recommendations for the department director, and awards get made in that manner.
Uh-huh.
Again, emergency projects do not have to compete in the quarterly competitive process because they're a priority, so we process them on a first-come, first-served basis based upon need. Due to the complexity of the program, what we have done is we have updated a grant management handbook that we provide to all applicants to help guide them through the federal regulations. We updated it for the first time in 7 years. We've also done many different things this year. We've also placed it on our web, a quarterly newsletter. We have a CDBG listserv, so we have many avenues this year of disseminating information. We also held workshops to convey this information to our applicants just a couple days ago where we had 94 attendees. And then these are our future requirements that we have that, again, as we discussed, there are method of distribution and our 5-year plans. This is the timeline for when we next have to update them. And then there are couple items that we could use your help on, and getting back to the big picture, and that is trying to help us get a larger annual allocation from Congress, and again, supporting the governor's request for the $4 million special disaster recovery allocation. In addition to that, the list just on the slide just contains a few of the program areas where there are changing in regulations that we're monitoring that could impact the program. And that's it.
Okay,
Thank you.
One question.
Yes, please. Vice Chair Lowe.
Quick question. I saw your presentation that the federal grant program, $3.9 billion. Mm-hmm. That's the 1 year, right? It's continually going down. I know the federal offshore program that make it smaller, but why state funding is also diminishing continually?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lim, committee members, again, it's a formula that the federal funds are divided under, and so the assumption is as the federal amount gets reduced, using the same formula that they currently allow funds to be transferred to states, that the reduction would be felt in all the states. And so I think if you were to look at every state under that distribution formula, based on the reduction of federal funds, everybody has taken a reduction equivalent to ours.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
And I apologize, Chair Witt and Representative Lim. That was on one of the slides I abbreviated at the end.
Thank you. You did exactly what I asked for. Thank you so very, very much. Mary, that was a very comprehensive report, and it's going to take me some time to try and digest it all. I know that you said that you are anticipating our help, and please make sure to keep us appraised through yourself and through Bob as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I'm sorry it's taken so long to get you here.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, just as a final comment, I think I wanted to focus on the one piece, and much credit is due to the governor and this disaster recovery activity. As you have been touched closely to your own personal life and your constituents around your region, as you saw, we sent the letter to HUD on December 18th.
Yes.
that relative to normal government working, that's a pretty fast pace to get identified how we could help your community partners find resources that would be made available to them in a very timely fashion. And we quickly, under the governor's leadership and all the agencies who have worked on the disaster recovery for the northwest part of our state, that was, again, one of our contributions that we continue to find other ways to help facilitate opportunities for that region of the state. This is a huge piece, as Mary and Ann mentioned. This becomes a very critical piece of that 25% funds needed, yes, to leverage the 75% of the FEMA dollars. When you have people who have been hit by this event that don't have anything, let alone 25%, there's a real opportunity they're going to miss that 75%. And so, as you saw the criteria, this is for low-mod people, so it's not going to be eligible for everybody, but many of those people, as Representative Witt is probably very aware of, that were hit by this disaster the hardest are people who meet this qualifier. And so I think there's a real strong probability and opportunity that these funds could be very key and essential in facilitating raising houses out of the floodway or floodplain so these people will not be displaced and still can be part of that community structure.
A tribute indeed to government working in partnership, and thank you so much for your efforts. Thank you very much. Committee members, very briefly, Monday the plan is to have a presentation on business development from the Economic and Community Development Department. Please take note when we're on the floor whether or not we've been able to schedule that. We have one person who has had a last-minute cancellation, and we may have to change things. So just watch that. With that, we stand adjourned until notice. Thank you.
Hey, Bob. Do you need to talk to her?
Whoops.
Go ahead. Just curious. I was in a small cities meeting a while back in Maupin, and